that was favoring one or the other. So he started to notice, okay, this figure becomes prominent because there's a ground. And then he reads Siegfried Gideon. That's really important, who was James Joyce's last buddy. Gideon and his wife buried James Joyce because he escaped Paris in like late 39, early 40, and got to Switzerland. And Gideon, being Swiss, they took him in and helped him for a year until Joyce died in the hospital in January 1941. Then they buried him. And his wife, Carol Gideon Welker, was a literary critic, an aesthete. And when she read Don Thiel's essay in Explorations in 1954, explaining Finnegans Wake, heavily influenced by McLuhan, she wrote to Don and McLuhan and said, this is the best essay I've ever read on Finnegans Wake. And this was the friend of James Joyce when he was writing Finnegans Wake or getting it published. Wow. So McLuhan caught on to Gideon, who did a book in 1939 called Space, Time, and Architecture. And he said that was one of the great moments of his life, reading that book. So he was reading. It then turns into a circle of people. He was drawn into a cabal, which includes Moholy Nagy, an artist and writer and theoretician, and Sergei Eisenstein, and all these guys involved with the arts, not limited to painting and sculpture and books. They were looking in the beginning of the multimedia arts, and they had a big influence on McLuhan. And it turns out they're all friends of Joyce. Sergei Eisenstein, the famous Russian filmmaker, he wrote one of the most perceptive articles or books on Finnegans Wake and Ulysses. These guys that were trying to understand what Joyce was doing and understood that involved newer media like movie and radio, they wrote the best essays, and they weren't literary critics. They were philosophers and movie makers. So you have Eisenstein, Moholy Nagy, and Gideon, all involved with Joyce, personal friends of Joyce, have a big influence on McLuhan. So he had the correct friends from Joyce and Wyndham Lewis to learn from in the 40s. And then he discovers Harold Innes in 49, 50, 51, technically not till 51 when he reads The Bias of Communication, which comes out that year. And that's the first book to look at media in isolation as dynamic influencers of all kinds of things in history. So he had already figured a lot of that out, and so Innes, who was a famous Canadian professor, sort of stamped what McLuhan was intuiting and already speaking about. Now he had somebody that he could quote. So he later says that Innes, all his writing is a footnote to Innes, but that's him putting on mainstream academia just so he can seem respectable. But if you read his writings in 43, 44, 45, before he knew of Innes, you see the influence of Gideon and media magic in his own lucky background.
Mm-hmm.
He was once asked a question like that. He said, how did you come to this? How did you figure this out? He says, luck. I was lucky in meeting very interesting people. So he attributed to, he met Wyndham Lewis personally in 43. Gideon became a friend later. All these pretty interesting people who were innovative and new and radical in their approaches and scholarly, he luckily tapped into that circle. So that's my answer. That's how McLuhan got there.
Fantastic. Thanks, Bob.
And if you read Gideon, and Lewis and any of these people, you think you're reading McLuhan. You think, oh, this is McLuhan, just ripped these guys off. That's how close these guys are to what he writes. I mean, he basically turns the Joyce world into an art form. He's not even a media ecologist. He just knows that he can use that as a figure to point out something else that's going on, which was pretty hard to explain, in academic terms or normal knowledge terms.
Yeah, so he was in a particular environment that had all these things flowing through it all the time. That's amazing.
Yeah. Now, here's Robert says, how did Aquinas massage the congregation? Let's just see. Alice says, good night for now. Love listening in and being with you guys. Great show, Bob. Really excited to learn about McLuhan and all. Robert says, what was Thomas Aquinas famous for, Bob? And did McLuhan cover this in his doctorate on this vicar? So, there was an upsurge of Gnosticism in the Pyrenees, Spain, the Albigensian Crusade. So there was this renegade movement in Spain and maybe France in the 1100s, 1200s that frightened the Vatican. So the Vatican had to come up with an argument against the Gnostics. And Thomas Aquinas came up with it, the doctrine of analogical proportionality, where he was able to show the fallacy or extremities of Gnostic thinking and how it wasn't appropriate to the Christian message. So Thomas Aquinas is very important for Catholic theology, and he becomes eventually he's recognized as the official Catholic philosopher, because he beat the Gnostics. Now, McLuhan himself became an expert in Gnostic ideas, Gnostic alchemy, and all that stuff. So he wasn't a reactionary to it, but he would, posit Gnosticism was a good guide to alchemy and the dynamics of the sensory world, which then taught you about the media world, and McLuhan... his early target was the Catholic layman. The average Catholic had no clue of the media dynamic shaping them and turning them into a non-Catholic insensibility, a Protestant insensibility unconsciously. So that was his first agenda in the 40s, was to update the sensibility of the Catholic. So he would use the enemy, Gnosticism, as a guide, necessary guide to sensory awareness that led to the creative process, which led to the learning process, which led to media extensions of that, and the importance of the arts and sciences, regardless of their pagan roots. And then he would, when he was around the artists and pagans and the Gnostics, he would point out that the breakthrough of the symbolists and the second romantics was that they were replaying the discoveries, the anthropological discoveries of the patristic fathers, like St. Augustine, who in 400 A.D. were running around with primitive pagan cultures and had to figure out how to make Christianity in any environment to that. So McLuhan said the discoveries made by the symbolists would not surprise the Catholics. The Catholic fathers of the church, like St. Augustine. And that's a pretty interesting point. And then that leads into Arthur Croker's great essay on St. Augustine's relevance to postmodernism. Croker says that St. Augustine is the first postmodernist, which is very McLuhan-esque to say that, because McLuhan was one of the first postmoderns, and you could even say Finnegan's Wake was a postmodern artifact.
Mm-hmm. He's like a postmodern priest, McLuhan.
A postmodern priest?
Yeah.
Yep. He was the first postmodern, because so many of the actual postmoderns, which I lay out in my long essay, The Six Schools of Mediacology, were just knockoffs of McLuhan. And the general breakthroughs of McLuhan, because he's analyzing the modernist age, and then I don't think he has the term postmodern anywhere. It's maybe in the 70s he threw it in. Maybe it was around by then. But he is showing how Joyce, let me see, where is this? Oh, yeah. This doctrine of the aesthetic moment in footnote 12, of the essay, The Aesthetic Moment in Landscape Poetry, page 167, he talks about the influence of Walter Pater in the ascetic moment, in the archetypal now, on Proust and Virginia Woolf. And then McLuhan says, but an understanding of the art of Joyce, Pound, Eliot, and Wyndham Lewis depends on seeing why they modified Pater's doctrine of the ascetic moment and depreciated the aims of Proust and Woolf. You'll see me in Roxy's video at Pierre Lachaise Cemetery at Proust's graveyard mocking Proust because he meets James Joyce and dies shortly after. I don't know if they met in 1922, but Joyce comes out to move past Proust with Ulysses, and Proust dies that year when Ulysses comes out in 1922. So you'll see me talking to those two young 16-year-olds about Proust and Joyce. So this is the post-aesthetic moment, the post-now that Joyce and Pound were getting into. So that's postmodern.
And McLuhan is definitely very postmodern in the sense that he gives a framework for relativism of kind of morals and values, a framework on which you can hang your hat of one kind of values on a visual framework and another one on an auditory framework, and provides at least an entry to an ability to explain where values come from if it's not that those values are eternal.
Right. The the values are cultural biases, and that's the learning process in a culture is dictated by the creative process, which is the artifacts that the tribe makes. So he will make statements like the Indian is the cerebral mechanism of the canoe. So the collective effort of the arts and crafts they have in a tribe become the creative position, which determine the learning process and the bias of the culture and their values, which would tend to be, once you have the printing press, tend to be eye values versus ear values. And then the 20th century has kinetic and tactile values, which go back to, you know, pre-sensibilities, Aboriginal sensibilities. So it's... there's an interesting statement. He talks about the city and how it becomes a character in Dickens and in Joyce and maybe some of the symbolists. The city becomes a person, a character. And what would it say about that? The that's the industrial environment as art form. Because the electric, the magnetic city, that was Wyndham Lewis' term, the electric radio world, the beginning of the global membrane or the global village, is superseding the city. So there's this famous lecture I heard in the CBC archives, McLuhan, in 1967, you know, at the peak of his fame, he's giving a major lecture at the University of Toronto. It's called the Marfleet Lectures. And he says, increasingly today, the city is becoming sacred. It's becoming something that people, you know, have a big identity around. So then you can. He then says, for this electronic yokel, the city is a psychedelic experience. This is the city of the '60s, and so if it's becoming sacred, it's becoming an archetype. And we're moving out of actual cities. We're not living in cities anymore. So in the 50s, he writes about the city. Maybe I could read that section, the city. Where is that? So I would go to page 57 of Interior Landscape. And he says... he says, however, it was in Flaubert's Sentimental Education, Flaubert, the French novelist, was in his book called Sentimental Education, that the acceptance of the city as the central myth or creation of man first leads to the mastery of that huge material by means of the technique of discontinuous landscape. So as more and more media are made, technologies and stuff in the 19th century, using the external landscape of nature as the container for your encyclopedic epic poem that maybe a Tennyson would write is not enough. So the city becomes the container. This is what the second wave of symbolism, Baudelaire's and that, they look at the urban environment as the new discontinuous landscape. So it was Flaubert's, it was in Flaubert's Sentimental Education that the acceptance of the city as the central myth or creation of man first leads to the mastery of that huge material by means of the technique of discontinuous landscape. Moreover, Flaubert makes a continuous parallel between the fatuity of Frederick Moreau's education, that's a character in Sentimental Education, education in quotes, and the deepening disorder and banality of 19th century Paris. So there's a parallel between the guy's banal education and the social society of 19th century Paris inside this amazing cauldron. And let's see. So then you go to 59, page 59. Now that will, that's another topic. In my notes I have it by city, but I'm not going to go into that right now. So then you go to page 129. And he says, inspired by Edgar Poe, I'm talking about Baudelaire. He's inspired by Edgar Allan Poe, and Poe was inspired by Coleridge. So Coleridge, Poe to Baudelaire. Baudelaire developed the technique of the interior landscape as a means of revealing the intensities generated by the harsh dissonances, overlayerings, and discontinuities of city life. The picturesque world of Wordsworth, on the other hand, has not proved capable of carrying the complex freight of modern experience, nor of assimilating the riches of the collective human past, which the modern poet needs to evoke in the midst of city landscapes. Then you go to page 154. So the interior landscape is the electric city. So there is a bit of external reality going on with the city, but it's way more complex than the Scottish Moor or the ocean or whatever was a natural epiphany for the first wave of symbolists, the Romantics. So let's see.
So, Bob, you're saying that when the environment or the, like you're saying, the moor and the beautiful lake, when that is the influence, that's a interplay between the ear and the eye going on. And then when the city becomes holy and becomes an environment or an art form, that's between kinesthetic and tactile interplay. Is that what you're...
Yeah. It would include the eye and ear, but the new aspect is the kinetic and tactile and proprioceptive. Right. So, yeah, it's good to point out that most poets had, of the first phase, the Romantics, they had eye and ear in their poems. They were balanced, and they would see the visual bias that Newton had created and try to balance it off with the significant discontinuous glance, glimpse, landscape, epiphany. So he says, let's see. Now, talking about the first wave of Romantics, for all their skill in discovering and manipulating external nature situations by which to render states of mind, the Romantics remain tied to the object when they wish only to present the object as a point from which to leap to another kind of vision. And that would be the analogical vision of Thomas Aquinas. So they repeatedly bog down in reflection just at the moment when they are ready to soar. they could not discover the technique of flight. It would be interesting to inquire how far the cessation of the poetic activity of Wordsworth and Coleridge was connected with this technical frustration. By means of the interior landscape, however, Baudelaire could not only range across the entire spectrum of the inner life, he could transform the sordidness and evil of an industrial metropolis into a flower. With this technique, he was able to accept the city as a central myth and see it as the enlarged shape of a man. That's like the city has all the extensions of the body in it. Just as Flaubert did in The Sentimental Education, Joyce in Ulysses, and Mr. Eliot in The Wasteland. So they saw the shape of man in the city. And in brackets, it is noteworthy that the English novel also preceded English poetry in the management of the city as myth, myth in quotes. Dickens was the first to make London a character or a person. And Henry James and Joseph Conrad, in their different modes, preceded Joyce and Eliot in assimilating the urban to the stuff of poesy. Moreover, the technique of inner landscape not only permits the use of any and every kind of experience and object, see, there's your being the pharaoh, using the whole world as your content, programming the whole world. Moreover, the technique of inner landscape not only permits the use of any and every kind of experience and object, it ensures a much higher degree of control over the effect, because the arrangement of the landscape is the formula of the emotion and can be repeatedly adjusted until the formula and the effect are in precise accord. Whereas the romantic poet and painter was much more dependent on the caprices of external nature, sketching, as Ruskin says of Turner, quote, the almost instantaneous record of an effect of color or atmosphere taken strictly from nature, that's the first romantic phase, the romantic and picturesque artists had to take advantage of accidents. After Baudelaire, there was no need for such accidents. The picturesque artist saw the wider range of experience that could be managed by discontinuity and planned irregularity, but they kept to the picture-like single perspective. So before Baudelaire, they were starting to see the discontinuous, the multi-level, but they couldn't abandon the single perspective. The interior landscape, however, moves naturally towards the principle of multiple perspectives, as in the first two lines of The Wasteland, where the Christian Chaucer, pagan encyclopedist Sir James Fraser, and New Age whack job Jesse Weston, 1920s version, and Jesse Weston are simultaneously present in the first two lines of The Wasteland. This is Cubist perspective, which renders at once a diversity of views, with the spectator always in the center of the picture. Always in picturesque art, the spectator is always outside. So in picturesque art, the detached visually biased spectator is outside, not in the new tribal drum of the urban city, so the spectator always in the center of the picture. The Cubist perspective of interior landscape typically permits an immediacy, a variety, and solidity of experience denied to the picturesque and to Tennyson. But the Romantics and Victorians, lacking this comprehensive and elastic technique, were compelled to remain nature poets, nature in quotes, whether they liked it or not. They were certainly conscious of having new art emotions, that's in quotes, but they were unable to achieve art conditions for them, and so continued to use external nature as a vehicle for art emotions. It was the science of their time that taught them to like nature, just as it is the science of our time, the quantum sciences, that has freed us from their particular kind of bondage to external nature. For it is perhaps a mistake to regard nature as the subject matter of the Romantics. They wanted not just to see it, but to see through it. That's Thomas Aquinas. And failing that, they made it an objective correlative for states of mind that are independent of it. So, start talking. I need to get a drink. You guys say some things.
Damn.
Have I overread your brains? Are you blown? Unable to conceive?
Fried, Bob.
Fried. We're, you know, I'm reading a lot, but you can take most of it, eh? You can follow what I'm saying.
Mm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I'm
it
like
zigzags
back out from
so
the
many portals.
So many portals?
Yeah, it zigzags across so many genres and
yeah.
portals, Bob.
Well, because McLuhan's encyclopedic, you know, like the rhetorician and the grammarian, but he has a surface dialectic all the time going on.
Hmm.
So what did you say, Brian? You were something?
Oh, just I'm speechless right now. I'm zooming back out from Tennyson, following along on that particular point now.
Yeah, what's great is, you know, they're all using the poetic process as intimately entwined with the learning process, which is not a profound statement. People learn, right? Living is supposed to be learning. And you have new experiences, which are usually media or man-made environments. So it's a cliche made into an archetype, from cliche to archetype. He's taking, you know, ordinary experience and making it extraordinary. The ordinary learning process, the ordinary unfolding of your sensory life becomes a key to all culture across the planet in all media. And that can be a satire. That can be a satirical. That idea, taking an aphorism or a cliche and making it an all-encompassing truth. Mm-hmm. And that's maybe a later understanding of McLuhan. But the he takes art is always the same, so we've stated the definition, but the conditions change. And what I always liked about reading this book and other literary essays he did, he would take a period, like Shakespeare's time, and talk about the dynamics that made that kind of artist show up, why Shakespeare became prominent. And then why did Donne became a famous poet? Why did Alexander Pope? What did they do? And he's so knowledgeable about all these guys. He read the whole history of Western literature, and so he would figure out a figure ground pattern of each phase. So it's an incredible education to read his essays. And what this book is like, the update of his PhD. Somebody mentioned the importance of his PhD. Was it you, Michael? Yeah.
I don't think so.
Brian did too.
I was saying everyone should definitely read that one, yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's the background to this. So it ends with the Elizabethan period, and he says James Joyce is the key to understanding the Elizabethan period the way 19th century critics didn't. They were too visually biased. So that interior, this book covers the period in detail of all the artists and painters and that from Elizabethan time to the 20th century. So this is his later development of his PhD. Because he's doing a figure ground on the PhD, now it's going to be a halfway figure ground, the ground being art content. Either external landscape or interior landscape, and then it'll become media figure ground. So the PhD starts, then it goes through his essays in the 40s, right after the PhD, and that's the transition of the same figure, why one figure dominates over other figures, what's the ground, and then it becomes the collective media grounds and why certain figures become prominent. Which is the same theme that his PhD was.
And by the end of the interior landscape with the ancient quarrel article, he brings it to the university and the style of teaching in the university, same subject as the PhD, except the content is not apparently poetic or literary. The content is, you know, like the overall teaching program of the university of all the different sciences.
Right. So maybe I take a break here, have something to drink, and then read Eugene McNamara's prologues. They're pretty, they understand what McLuhan's doing. And he points out that, note that he ends the book with the beginning, because that article, Ancient Quarrels, is a summary of his PhD. And he makes that the end. So the crime is his PhD, and now he's going to explain where the crime came from by developments that his PhD didn't cover.
There's a great flipping in the pattern of seeing how the invisible environment, say, for example, language was first an invisible environment. And then we have this alphabet, which turns that into a visible environment. So we say in the beginning was the word. But we're also seeing how this visible environment, taking first nature as the creative process, how that now becomes the invisible environment that we're in now. So it's seeing the flipping of the invisible to the visible to the back to the invisible.
Right. Now, what part of now, are you saying the creative process is the invisible
environment? Well, the
today?
Environment has gone, we went from nature, being inspired by nature, then we went to the city, that place became an individual, a person, and then the city, like you said earlier on, we don't even live in cities anymore, and that environment becomes invisible again. And so there's even a new environment now that's invisible. So we've moved from a visible to invisible environment through this whole pattern.
Right. Well, all environment, the printing press was a visible medium, but it was an invisible environment. All media, regardless of whether they're heard or what sensory dynamic they have, are invisible at the beginning.
Yeah.
So I don't know if I think what you said was a little sloppy. Need to refine that.
Bob, is he applying the tetrad right throughout all of his material? I mean, does he get through the enhancement, the obsolescence, retrieval, and then reversal, and then it's just in a sense that tetrad working its way all the time? Is that his methodology, or is that also?
No, that's
quite
a good
sloppy?
Point. The tetrad is the stages of human apprehension. I lay out some new information. I extend something here. It obsolesces what you thought. Well, Brian's question, why did McLuhan, so the puzzlement about why McLuhan shifted, that gets obsolescent. Mm-hmm. It retrieves an appreciation of Dante or something, whatever it did for you, mm-hmm. and then push to extreme is mm-hmm. going to flip into what I haven't talked about yet. So you look mm-hmm. at the way one engages knowing or the drama of cognition, it is a tetrad.
Yeah.
So you look through his early writings, he talks about what gets obsolesced, what gets retrieved, and what it flips into. He doesn't use those words, but those patterns are latent, and once you become well-versed in the interior landscape, you know what I mean? Now, in his report to the National Society of Educational Broadcasters, National Association of Educational Broadcasters, that's what he wrote for in 1960. He went around, and so what became Understanding Media was written in 1960 because educational broadcasters were wondering what was going on. Elvis was running amok, and the kids were odd, and Sputnik was happening. So they wanted to figure out what was going on. So the first guy who kind of dealt with this new world of media was McLuhan. So he was hired, and the report was even read into Congress and denounced. It was called Project 69, the short title, Project 69. So McLuhan got ill in the middle of it and almost died. But he did this report, and then it becomes background for Gutenberg Galaxy and Understanding Media. But the report has fourfold charts. It takes each medium and shows as the upper left-hand corner, upper right, bottom right, bottom left. And it's a dialectic between sensory closure and sensory impact. Don Fields always said that basically that's a tetrad. If you look at them closely, you got to get a copy of the report. You have to get it from Ann Arbor. It's the place where they sell PhDs, so you have to order it from there. It's not published yet, but it's really really good. It even has transcripts of TV shows he did around then, interesting Toronto TV, CBC shows. But the tetrad is latent there in 1960. But on the surface, in Understanding Media, he's got extension, he's got obsolescence, he's got flip points, but he doesn't have retrieval. And then he does this book, Cliched Archetype, which is all about retrievals late 60s, 1970. And then he comes up with the tetrad, which, for the record, was done by Barrington Nevitt and McLuhan, not Eric McLuhan. George Thompson backs that up, and Barrington never told me. Eric was away in 72 in Madison, Wisconsin, I think, working on some part of his education, and that's when Barry Nevitt and McLuhan came up with the tetrad. And when Eric came back, Marshall wanted to give him a role, so Barry sort of stood off to the side and let Eric get involved with the early development of the tetrad to give Eric a role. That's what Barry says. Now, it might be total bullshit, but they had the tetrad. They presented it in 1974, and so they had to work it out a couple of years before, and George Thompson, McLuhan's aide at that time, who succeeded McLuhan's brother, Morris McLuhan, who was the aide when in 1971, because I dropped in 71 and met Morris McLuhan, then he was gone in 72, say, and George Thompson comes in, and George Thompson is very adamant that Eric did not help make the tetrad. It was done by Barry and Marshall. So just for the record, I'll say that. Nobody knows that, and just to put that into the stew. But the retrieval factor, which is spelled out in cliche archetype, was the missing part, McLuhan said, to complete the tetrad.
But is it safe to say that this, the tetrad overlays every aspect of our lives, aside from mediacology? I mean, you could apply this to absolutely everything in life, surely.
Well, media is referring to everything in life. Anything a human creates is a medium, so it's everything ecology.
Yes. So you enhance it to obsolescence, and you retrieve it, and then you've got that flip.
Well, I'm saying that's the actual stages of apprehension that he was looking for. Mm. And so he actually comes up with a summation of human knowledge with the tetrad, and he calls it laws of media. It's the only practical knowledge to have as a citizen in our time. So, and we live in a post-knowledge fucking, dance.
Right.
So it's not so great what knowledge, it's not so tremendous what knowledge was thought it was looking for. It was the product of the book. And it's interesting that McLuhan says that you have the novel, Ulysses is the last novel, and then Finnegan's Wake is post-book and the last book and all that. What comes after them? Sociology, psychology, and anthropology. He says that those ologies are the last gasp of the book. So people start reading sociology and anthropology, and there's different popular versions of that. McLuhan called it the you done it. Not the who done it, but the you done it. Sort of popularizations of anthropological discoveries, sociological discoveries, and psychological discoveries, like a book like I'm Okay, You're Okay, what's that, transactional psychology. That becomes the popular education and literature and what people read, and then it gets extremely refined into New Age literature. But it's an important point to make that novels died in the 20s, yet people had to keep reading books, so it became sociology and psychology and anthropology. That's an important insight. And then that now that dies, the book ain't relevant at all. It has no constituent factor other than people will still have the book experience, retrieve it as a meme, I call it, an Android meme. But the so the final knowledge, the most comprehensive knowledge for book realities, to have the world end in a book, which was the statement of one of the poets, I think Mallarmé may have said, the world, you know, exists to end in a book. Well, that was before. Now it ends in the YouTube. But the McLuhan wrote the final book that included, and he writes about poetry studying, using sociology, anthropology, and psychology. He does a book with that, plus the new study of media. He says anthropology studies cultures as art forms, whereas the student of media studies media as art form. So he writes the last book. And when you first read it, it's a mind-blowing expanding of your mental mind, of your labyrinth of your mind, looking for concepts to get a grip on reality. But it's puny compared to what people experience today. most of people's experience today is not categorized, not remembered.
Yeah.
That's interesting, Bob, because in the 80s, I went to university in the early 80s, and one could do a BA degree, which we used to call Be Anything, but it was a Bachelor of Arts.
Right.
And in that degree, the main three subjects that everyone took in addition to what they were else they were looking at would be psychology, sociology, and anthropology. So
right.
there you see it as...
That's what the university had to invent to keep their foundation, the printing press, viable. The university was preserving civilized visual space, so they had to bring in... Remember, those things were controversial in the end of the 19th century. They were bad people, sociologists, psychologists, and anthropologists. They were a whack job. Look at Freud, man. He wasn't popular at first. So they were like an update of the artist. So most of you would remember that the idea of the poet, like a Jim Morrison poet, that I remember people having in the 60s, maybe after the Beatniks, was a spontaneous guy who fucking didn't study anything. He just could mouth off, right? It's a retrieval of the rhapsode. And when you started reading McLuhan, it was surprising that he said, to be a poet, you read anthropology, psychology, and you knew all about the science of the day? You don't associate that with Ginsberg and any other popular poet, which then became rock and roll. Do you have to know anthropology to be a fucking rock star? No. And that's the post-book poetry. But a lot of the dynamic after World War II would be that the poet was the guy who didn't fucking go to school, who partied, who drank, who had exotic experiences, took drugs. You know what I mean?
Right.
No concept. It was free of conceptual baggage.
And in Dead Poets Society, they have... poetry being like a fundamentally anti-school kind of force that inevitably comes into conflict.
The spontaneity, spontaneous primitive nature. And there are quotes that I can get into maybe next time about that. Spontaneous cliche. And that's why a poet like Gerd Stern, who was a spontaneous kind of poet, beatnik poet, and then a hippie poet, he had no idea that McLuhan was a fucking poet. He was a friend of McLuhan's, corresponded with him. I have the letters. And Gerd, who's an important multimedia artist in the history of art and is, you know, invited to art schools all over the world now, until he read Don Thiel's book on McLuhan, it never occurred to him that McLuhan was a poet. And...
Yeah.
For me, Gerd Stern has a lot to learn that McLuhan was not only a poet, he was the only fucking poet. And you fuckers run around in the art world or the poet world or whatever you're here, the Robert Priest world, if you're a Trontonian, are nowhere near what poetry could be in the 20th century, which is what McLuhan did. He integrated, since people lived in the information environment, it has to be a poetry of the information society. And that's what he did. He found a way to put a symmetrical a vision of beauty about the whole thing, about media ecology and the harmony in our world. You know, supposedly the poet comes up with some kind of vision that shows the harmony that nature has, or then the symbolist, the harmony of the city. Well, McLuhan came up with the harmony of the global theater, and that's what people don't recognize. They think he's somebody applying a medicinal therapy to society through the computer. And that is a subset in the work, but if that never got applied, then his vision becomes the poetry. So that's why he still remains powerful for people to read. He's powerful like the old poets were. They have truths that resonate over a long span of time.
News that stays news.
Yeah, that great line from Ezra Pound. So that's why me being there now, and we go into me since nobody's around, we can get into good stuff. That's why I'm the greatest poet alive today, Because what was the poet of today to do? Since most people go around gathering experiences, they grew up in classrooms, they go to seminars, they go to lectures, they go to workshops. There's a lot of sitting around trying to relive your grade 8 classroom. You ever think of that? The whole, how much people go and listen. Just look at the McLuhan Salon in Toronto that bores the hell out of Brian. He goes to them and a bunch of people sitting there, educate me. No, give me a lecture. So the art of that situation would be a collection of the best lecturers and put them together as the best panel. That's my Fatty Communion book. And these guys have to be cult, and they run semi-cults themselves. So you got William Irwin Thompson, LaRouche, McLuhan, and Croker, and then Dobbs is the MC, so to speak. But you have to work with the information consumption to come up with a new poem. So I say my book, Fatty Communion, is a great poem. It's a great appealion, and we'll get into that later. And yet, today it has to be a subset of many media in your arsenal. The poem is all the media you create, not just being a verbal poet or a spoken poet or to be a rock musician. You got to cover it all. And I've been around long enough to hang out with the greats and then come up with a harmonious vision of the interplay of all of them.
Mm-hmm.
That's how I updated McLuhan's Information Society poetry. But yeah.
Well, Fatty Communion also does a good job of updating that, what I was saying about McLuhan being a postmodern initiator in the sense of building a framework for the relativism that you make that you kind of, for instead of being a bunch of sensory spaces, you kind of nail that and in Up the Orphic Anti, you kind of explain it that, you're nailing it down to four types, that there's,
well,
there's
you know
four
what it is?
Four basic truths.
No, four cults.
Okay, yeah, four basic types of being wrong.
Yeah, cults. And cults is not derogatory. Most of society has to be run in little cabals and cults. It happens in corporate life. It happens everywhere. That's why society is divided today. You got too many fucking cults happening in politics and in business and everywhere. Because it's a retrieval of the medieval guilds and then a retrieval of all the different clans and tribes of ancient times. And then you have individual, because you can become a super angel, you naturally have a cult, your consumer base. Your demographic is, so the battle of the cults is the new poetry today. I engage all these different cults. Interesting. That's what Worcester said. He once, years ago, I laid out the 10 holy offices to him, and he was one of them. And then I heard he told Jerry Falker something. He says, "Well, Bob, he gathers cults. He infiltrates cults and then makes a radio show out of them." That's what he recognized. He was the first.
And organizes them against each other.
Right. So McLuhan talks about the cult of the East versus the cult of the West. And he says, "I will not be part of either of them." The paramodern, that's postmodern, the paramodern aesthete must engage all cults and orchestrate them the way McLuhan said you would orchestrate media and your senses. The orchestrating the cults is orchestrating my daily behavior, because most people walk around encountering cults, from the street pamphlet fucking guy at the airport to the local arts council that you're trying to get a grant from.
It makes sense that was part of Colbert's appeal too, was one of the favorite gags or things he would occasionally bring out was mobilizing his audience and commanding them to everybody go to the Urban Dictionary and create your own filthy definitions for the phrase Canada's history. He would bomb people with his audience.
Yeah.
It was ironically set up so that people were enthusiastically throwing themselves into obeying his commands.
Yeah, including making him president. He demanded them to make him president, which is part of the modern cult behavior. You must run for the presidency at some point.
Yeah.
So,
it's like the ultimate
Bob, are you going to stop at the top of the hour?
Well, we're just getting some good stuff now. We're applying McLuhan and flipping into Dobbstown. I got to give Bill. Is he asking?
Not only do you have to give Bill notice, but you played a song deliberately at the beginning of the show, and we still haven't covered that.
Oh, you're talking about the song? Yeah, no.
Yeah,
we're supposed to go 6 hours. We're supposed to go 6 hours, and we've done four. So we can go at least one more, because we're actually getting into a new something we never talked about before. the ecologists of cults, which is what I achieved. This is why I am an outlier. I am not considered respectable because I actually dare to hang out with cults.
And, you're a fringe dweller, Bob.
Yeah, I handle all the multi fringes, but the academic pretends that they are not engaged in street commercial cult activity. That's why you're not allowed to just teach one person. You must teach a range of fucking idiots that show you that you're detached, like the visually biased civilized mode the meme they represent, and they're not allowed to focus on one guy. Well, you can, if you're free and not tied down to that techno-peasant world of university, you're free to engage the multimedia cults, because academia is usually just making sure they don't look like a literary cult. So you have to read other books, you know, and you get bogged down in the Gutenberg galaxy too much. It actually makes you a pretty frustrated, you know, magnesium-deficient person eventually if you stay around in university too long. I mean, we hear from every PhD candidate how they almost die doing it. You know, it's just a horrible experience because they got to fit into the academic cult, the academic guidelines of respectability of not allowing to be a cult or even creating one.
Right. Yeah. Except, I mean, to take the example of Croker anyway, I was stunned to read this article they came out with and recently about that it just I didn't finish it yet, but about two-thirds of the way through, it's just it takes a campaign talking point of Hillary Clinton's at face value and is purporting to analyze the new situation according to the face value analysis offered by the opposing candidate of the president-elect. Like,
is this a new essay on C-theory?
Yeah, it's not that new. It's from, I think, December. But
okay.
It's analyzing it in terms of this, like, well, clearly it's racist white supremacy and a desire for whiteness and a resurgence of racist nativism is the factor here that we are dealing with. And they were talking about Obama as if it was him in the election. Like, they didn't mention Clinton even until much later. Their initial contrasting of, like, so what choice will America make? Will it be the grace and the we haven't said a single negative or even slightly cynical word about Obama's performance at the grieving ceremony of the church where people were killed when he sang Amazing Grace?
Yeah.
Will people go with the grace or with the vulgar white thing?
So,
like, and I'm like, these are the Croakers?
Yeah, yeah. Croker is floundering. I noticed they made a major statement about the Trump. Uh-oh, we're in a new world. Us, we got to get our postmodern shit together. We got to deal with this new fucking environment or something. And they're not being very cool about it. They are actually looking biased in their approach to this phenomenon. You know, that's not what Croker has been. He's been orbiting over everything and talking about it all as surplus flesh or Android meme and this and that, but he doesn't get personally threatened by anything. He's sounding personally threatened by Trump.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to have to get out in the street and demonstrate. Leave the Irish.
I mean, there's maybe some kind of a rationale to bringing up the whiteness thing if it's a sort of a, you know, there's some AP body level thing that way, but they're not. It's not like they were even referring to it as a symptom of some new
right.
medical condition.
That's right. It's not a figure. It's a ground, and it's threatening Coker's ground. And he thought that his ground would swallow all grounds for the next 100 years.
Mm.
So his tenure, his mortgage is being threatened. There's a lot to go into Trump. I mean, I'm the only one who comes up with a totally original way to deal with this without getting bogged down in the semantics of cult behavior. I don't know if I want to get into that right this moment. But the juxtaposition, like, this is interesting. Most people today end up in some kind of cult. And so the academic, he's the switchboard, and he makes sure his students don't become cult victims. The professor becomes a cult in the university in this dynamic. And so they have a lot of involvement with the students that the students become very dependent on them. And then the professor has to get the student a job. And so pretending they're not a cult, since they will not recognize that cult behavior is inevitable, they will not allow themselves to be seen as a cult. And so their whole reason to be is to protect the kids from cults out there, right, left, or center, and in business.
Right.
And that's a false, hypocritical agenda because they're turning into a cult. They're becoming what they behold. So the new way to be a poet is to accept or recognize the cult world and make a fucking poem, a panorama around the best cults on the planet.
Right.
That's what yours truly did.
Well, yeah, it's also good the way that your the tiny note chart has an ideogram of just why limit yourself to verse ideograms. Just pack as many allusions in there as necessary to build the portrait in one, it's one syllable, basically, one gigantic paragraph.
Yeah. And continue.
And?
Yeah, it continue. You could.
Yeah, what do you do? It's like, what do they call this? It's like a advent calendar, those ones where it's like all the weeks leading up to Christmas. Open one little door every day. It's a plan for treasures you're going to unlock over the next couple decades as you get into all
you
these names.
What'd you say, Nick?
I said he's quite right. It's like an old advent calendar.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting is that LaRouche, McLuhan, Zappa, Beter, Thompson, May Brussel, who are the other guys? Croker and LaRouche. They all warn everybody and explain cult behavior.
Right.
And they became cults themselves.
Right,
and
LaRouche had the balls to to really make a cult, make a good one.
Well, in the traditional sense.
Yeah.
McLuhan made a cult in another way. They're all subtle cults in different ways. So then Bob comes in and is the anthropologist of cults, but we won't even call it anthropology. It's something else. It's the analyst of memes. Temporary nano memes that develop fanatic supporters, and then has a joke cult to refer to on top of it, which itself is an exploiter or a follower of many cults. That's what the Church Sub Genius is. They are actually the anthropologists of many cults because you look in their books, they list. You ever looked at their stalactite charts in the book of the Sub Genius? They've got like 100 cults listed.
Mm-hmm.
Many, many, all kinds of disciplines. Some of them academic and Joycean cult. So the Church Sub Genius is the anthropologist of cults, and then that becomes a cult itself. And then I'm the analogical mirror of that trend. So it's perfect. You couldn't get a better expression of our time than what I did.
Oh yeah. Well, you did the performance so that you, your name, what it means is the flipping point of the Church of the Third Venus.
Yeah, and of course I have to be claimed to be a cult too. I am the worst cult that the Joker cults were afraid of.
Perfect example of everything wrong.
Yeah, and, you know, the Fire Sign